Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I'd like to welcome all of you back to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder. We are talking about the Billy Meier case this afternoon, and I'm reading one of his books, going through it for the third time. The book is called The Might of Thoughts, and I'm going to bring out some of the concepts I'm pulling out from this book. What I'm looking at right now of interest is dealing with human emotions. And the Meier information says that emotions are different than feelings. Feelings are something that arise slowly, and usually feelings come into existence because of thoughts. Now, emotions are something completely different. Emotions are reactions, and emotions come up spontaneously, and they are hard to bring under control using our thoughts. It's a very difficult thing. Again, emotions are reactions, but emotions can create thoughts in themselves. And emotions often start what you might call states of excitation, like laughter, crying. And a lot of times, emotions arise so quickly that we don't even personally notice them, but other people may. And these emotions cannot be steered. Like, one of the thinking skills that the Meier information tells us about is to learn to steer our thoughts. Well, emotions cannot be steered. They just arise suddenly, and we're practically out of control before we know it. And part of the challenge we face is learning to continually monitor ourselves so that we do stay in a neutral, positive frame of mind. One of the ways to keep in a state of happiness is to be neutral, positive in our thinking. The creation, the universal consciousness, is neutral, positive. The Meier information says that the superintelligence, which created our universe, created all things, maintains our universe, is really not what the religions have told us. It's a neutral positive entity. It's neither good nor evil. And it's neutral positive. And our thoughts should be neutral positive. When our thoughts are neutral positive, those are considered good thoughts. Good thoughts will produce good feelings. Good feelings will lead to good habits. Good habits lead to good circumstances in your life. And part of the teaching of the Spirit is learning to control our thinking. Because, as the Meier information explains, our thoughts, our correct thoughts and knowledge, are such a monstrous power that they will continually bring into existence all of our desires and wants. Notice I said correct thoughts and knowledge. The problem is we have thoughts that are not correct. And typically thoughts that come from emotions that come up and arise quickly are not neutral positive. They're not balanced. And to make things even more complicated, we have unconscious processes of perception that are going on in our minds. And these unconscious processes of perception influence our psyche. What is our psyche? The psyche is the area in the material consciousness that controls the thoughts and the feelings of the material consciousness. Remember, we have a spirit form, which is part of our midbrain. It resides in an area called the superior colliculus. The spirit form, you can think of as the permanent you, the real you, When you incarnate, when your spirit form comes into the body of a child, at 21 days, that embryo becomes a person, and thoughts start to take place in that embryo. From that point on, from that 21st day after the sperm fertilizes the egg, you then have not only a spiritual consciousness, you have a material consciousness. And the spirit form needs a material consciousness in order to evolve. Without a material consciousness, the spirit form can't evolve. So that's why we have material lives, so that we can continue this evolutionary process. There's many, many lifetimes. But the strangeness of all of this is you get many lifetimes, but every time you incarnate, you get a new personality, and you'll have a new body. Now, deep within your and my subconscious is the wisdom of our predecessor personalities. It's not apparent typically to the conscious mind what's there. So we get what are called impulses. We get these signals. They kind of put us and move us in the right direction. So every time you grow up as a child, you have to go through this maturation process again. And for years and years, the wisdom of your predecessor personalities are going to impulse the material consciousness and kind of give you heads up. In other words, you kind of get a little advantage that way. And that's the way wisdom kind of builds on wisdom. In addition to that, there are storage banks of information in the universal consciousness. Our universe has storage banks which send signals, and you'll get signals, impulses, from these storage banks. Now, you have to be in a certain mindset to be able to sense these impulses. You have to be in a neutral, positive mindset. You have to be relaxed. You have to be open-minded, and you have to be, I think, in search of higher knowledge and information. Now, I continually tell this one story. I go back to this again and again. It must be significant. But Billy is a young boy growing up in Bulak, Switzerland. We'll get these impulses from the storage banks. And he has an article that he's written. It's called How It All Began. It's up on the Billy Meyer Wiki. If you Google the big Billy Meyer Wiki, you can read this paper. And Billy was about 4 years old. He was sleeping one evening, growing up in Bulak, Switzerland, in a little town called Niederflachs/Bulak. And Bulak is a municipality in Switzerland in what they call the Canton of Zurich. And it's near what they call the Glatt Valley. And it was about 3 a.m. on a mild night in May in 1941. And Billy crawled out this lower window and he sat on a bench that his father had made. And he looked up at a beautiful starry sky and he heard a voice in his head that said, "My life is made out of the love of creation." And a short time later, he heard his own voice speaking as if he wasn't intentionally creating these words, but he heard his own voice, his own lips say this. He said, "Since ancient times, you have lived among the stars." And at that point, Billy knew what his mission on this earth was. And many years later, he recognized that he was getting these impulses from the universal storage banks, and perhaps the importance of this story is that you and I learn to look up at that sky and open ourselves up to these impulses. Because he was looking at a beautiful starry night, And as he said, he recognized that the light which the stars emitted was a light in the visible spectrum, but there was an invisible light that he called the love of creation. And this was a creational thing. It was for what was called all great time, there is this thing called the love of creation. And at a very young age, Billy knew that everything which exists in the whole universe is a manifestation of the might and the infinite and true love of the mighty universal consciousness. Now, this universal consciousness is not what we would call God. It has no personality. It radiates love. The incredible splendor of nature is the visible expression of the love of creation. But it's not a Wesen, as they say in the German. It doesn't have a personality. Your dog, your cat, your horse, of course people have personality. All but the higher animals have personalities. But this intelligence does not. Neither is it good nor evil. It doesn't take sides in wars. It doesn't take sides in the football game. It's not what our religions have told us. The universe is a far stranger thing than we imagine. And what is particularly unusual about it is that we get many, many lifetimes. We reincarnate on the planet that we die on. But the responsibility lies with us. In other words, your spirit form is going to get impulses from the storage banks, yes. And you're going to get impulses from the wisdom of your predecessor personalities, yes. But there really is not guardian angels looking over you, except for your own consciousness. There is no God in the religious sense of the word looking over you in that sense. But the universal consciousness does radiate love, and it does want to come into harmonious concord with all things that are living. But you are responsible for the circumstances in your own life. And that's what's so important about this book, is that it reveals the might of our own thinking, because our thoughts are immensely powerful. As it says, our thoughts are such a monstrous power that they continually bring into reality everything that we desire. Now, the problem is we don't know how to utilize these thoughts. We have unconscious thoughts. We have emotions that flare up. We have subconscious processes that are going on, and all of these things play a role in the circumstances of our lives. So the key to start to have total control over the circumstances of your life is to learn to steer your consciousness, to steer your thinking. Because if we learn, if we can recognize what are neutral positive thoughts, the good thoughts, the healthy thoughts. A lot of times, neutral positive thoughts will produce calm in your life. They'll produce a good feeling. They'll produce a sense of motivation. And if you can clarify those thoughts, repeat those thoughts, say things aloud if you have to, then those thoughts can be more purposive, more productive. Your life can become more harmonious. And if you repeat those thoughts, if you apply effort, practice, patience, then you can start to have a harmonious life. Now, part of the challenge is continually we will slip up and we'll have emotions that flare up. But the key is to be able to stop those kinds of emotions, those kinds of thoughts, because lower thoughts lead to lower feelings, which lead to lower circumstances in your life, because you start lower habits. See, your consciousness is like a garden, and if negative, bad, unproductive thoughts start to manifest, they'll be like weeds in your garden, and they'll just go everywhere. And then you have a whole psyche that's plagued by negative repeating thoughts. And that's one of the big problems that we all face, are dealing with these negative repeating thoughts. Please, I urge you to take time to learn to meditate. I don't follow exactly the Meyer meditation processes. Probably, maybe I should, but one of Randy Winter's books that I read kind of taught me this process that I've kind of depended on. If you imagine a positive, something positive, like let's start with a color, a blue sky, and imagine a blue sky, maybe some little white clouds in there, and just keep that image in your mind. Don't allow any verbal thoughts to come in. Just look at that blue sky and those little white clouds and just breathe deep, relax, get rid of some of that negative energy. And now imagine green rolling hills. And they may even have a blue sky over the top of them. Now breathe deep again, relax. Let's go with some of that negative energy. And then imagine a sun, a beautiful yellow sun in that blue sky that you originally started with. Exhale again and get rid of some of that negative energy. So now you put yourself in a relaxed state of mind. You're focused. You're not having any negative repeating thoughts. And you're back to neutral positive. So that's one of the skills you can look at. If you want to take this one step farther, imagine a rose or a setting sun, and then or a flame, a candle flame, and just in your mind's eye, look at that candle flame and watch it just flicker as it slowly changes, as it slowly changes. Now, if you're really comfortable, like if you're in your recliner, if you have a reclining chair and you go into a deep relaxed state here, there's a kind of sleep meditation state that you can go into, and it's extremely pleasurable. It will restore your body when you're fatigued. It will, if you're emotionally exhausted, it will take that exhaustion away. See, we human beings were shaken and were knocked about by the circumstances of our life. Many times we think we're helpless and we cannot, you know, we must just react to these external conditions. And that's not true. We can be the master of our lives if we practice self-cognition, if we practice self-control. Because that which the human being thinks, he makes real. Good and positive thoughts must be tended and nurtured. If you're thinking anxious thoughts, then you're going to bring about anxious situations in your life. You need to remember that anything that's causing you anxiety is just an obstacle. The human should have a good positive opinion of himself or herself. Sometimes we're a little too critical of ourselves. We need to nurture, to feed and protect good positive thoughts. Because if you don't, you can fall and become a criminal, a felon. You can fall into depravity. You can be jealous. You can be a hater. And these are self-destructive things. Now, the fetus, the child, actually thinks in the womb. And I was talking earlier in the show about how the spirit form enters the womb at 21 days. Whether you consider that tiny child an embryo or a fetus doesn't really matter so much. But there is thinking in the womb. It's incredible. There are thoughts that occur in the womb, and I believe at 21 days when the spirit form comes in, that's when the heart starts to beat. By the third month, the fetus can feel pain. Now, this is important to understand because on page 36 of the Mind of Thoughts, it says that thoughts pertaining to profound learning and the forming of personality as well as the forming of morality and the psyche and the basic character are already developing in the human being in the womb, which is incredible. You know, there's also in our universe something called the energy fetus in creation. And this is called the tiny core of creation, where the Big Bang developed. Well, we also start out as human beings as a fetus. So we see these repeating patterns in nature, in the microcosm and in the macrocosm. We have the spiraling arms of the galaxy. We have the spiraling arms at our DNA in the microcosm. We have the lightning bolt, which goes across the sky in a branching kind of fractal structure. And same with our circulatory system. It branches. We see branches on a tree. You see, the creation works in these repeating patterns in all places in nature. And the human being attracts that which he is. Now, Billy has written a book, another book, which I haven't read. I've only read the bits and pieces of it that have been translated. The book is called Arahat Atharasata. And it's a book about the final plane, the spiritual plane, where all spirit forms eventually end up, all human spirits. And it takes about 60 to 80 billion years for the spirit form to evolve into this form. We spend about 40 to 60 million years reincarnating into a material body. So, and that's the first five stages of evolution. These Pleiaren that Billy are in contact with are at stage five. You know, that stage called life and creational wisdom. At that stage, human beings become what's called the Ishwish, the king of wisdom. And that takes 40 to 60 million years of spending time in the physical, time in the spiritual, back into the physical, back into the spiritual, this reincarnating process back and forth as the spirit form continues to gain wisdom. Now, after stage five, the human spirit no longer starts to need a completely physical body. And it takes 60 to 80 billion years reincarnating to a half spiritual, half material body to finally completely no longer need a physical body. That's called the high council level, sometimes they call it. It's the sixth stage. Now, the seventh stage is purely spiritual. So we've completely evolved out of the need for a physical body. And we're at the first level of the spirit plane is called Arahat Atharasata, which, by the way, means... Oh, what does that mean? The precious one who contemplates the times or something along that time. This is This is explained in Contact Report 3. If you want to go out and read that in Contact Report 3, it'll talk about that there are people that live in such lofty spheres in these half-material forms and we can no longer communicate with them. Now, Arahat Athrasada is where Billy got this message, which I quoted several times. Correct thinking and knowledge is such a monstrous power that is able to ceaselessly attract and bring into being everything that the human thinks and longs for. That's important because we have to be careful what we long for and what we wish for. Because sometimes we wish for things which are really not good for our lives, which are not good for our evolution. The purpose of our physical life is evolution. In order to evolve your spiritual consciousness, you will have to learn to think independently. Unfortunately, today, most people do not think independently. We think what we're told to think. We think what the newspaper sends us, what the YouTube tells us, what the news tells us. We need to learn to think independently to steer our thoughts. And what Billy calls God is the inner self from which the might of thoughts come. There is still the superintelligence, the universal consciousness. But through the might of our thoughts comes a state of inner freedom or inner imprisonment. You know, if you have these negative thoughts, have negative feelings, you'll start to have negative habits and you'll get bad circumstances in your life. That's a form of inner imprisonment. If you think a thought and you don't steer that thought into the neutral positive state, if you don't steer your thinking, it'll end up in usually an inner imprisonment and bad circumstances. But you don't have to. If you'll try to steer your thoughts, they'll lead to inner freedom and you'll have good circumstances in your life. So how do we steer our thoughts? You know, the Meyer information has a very peculiar take on prayer. And what it says is that wishes and prayers are never petitions to a god or a saint. Rather, they are thoughts generated by oneself, which are fed back out of the consciousness and inner self to one's own consciousness and inner self, where they create fulfillment. I'll read one here. This is an original prayer that was created by Henoch. And it says, "My spirit, you are almighty. Your name shall be honored. Your realm shall open within me. Your might shall unfold within me, on earth and in the universes. Give me my daily bread," meaning love and wisdom, "today, so I recognize my responsibility and I recognize the truth, and do not throw me into confusion and delusion, but release me from my misunderstanding. For the realm, the power, and the knowledge within me are yours in eternity." So we're almost praying to our own material consciousness block. And because that's where all the conscious evolution of the human being is done. Now this was a prayer of Nokodanian. And it says, "My spirit, you are all-knowing, all-capable, all-wise, all-truthfully, and all-loving in me. Your name shall be honored." Now, who is Nokodanian? Well, there was a person named Nokodanian at one time, and he had a spirit form like every person does. The spirit form Nokodanian is the same spirit form that has incarnated on the earth as Enoch, Elijah, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Emmanuel, and Muhammad, and now as Edward Albert Meyer. Nicodemian is a very, very ancient spirit, I think 9.6 billion years old. This spirit form has come down from these higher spiritual realms to live material life again, to bring into on the earth, in written form, the teaching of the Spirit. The teaching of the Spirit is what I'm talking about today. It's a series of teachings that deal with what creation is, what the universal consciousness is, what the spirit form is, what reincarnation is all about. It teaches us how to control our thoughts, how to take responsibility for ourselves and for our lives. The teaching of the Spirit is what's going to eventually take us out of what's called the third millennium. See, we're in what's called the third millennium now, which is this very, very difficult transition period, because we here on the earth are in stage two of evolution. We're kind of locked here. We're stuck here. We have the capability for rational thought, but we haven't been rational enough to really become an intelligent society yet. So we are in danger of destroying ourselves. So to stop the trend of self-destruction, it all comes down to personal responsibility of every human being to learn to control their thoughts, even during the most difficult of circumstances. Because you should be rational in your thinking. You should radiate love. Remember, love is the highest principle in creation. Every tiny plant, every tiny animal fulfills its purpose in love. Only the human being with his free will can turn away from his purpose, can turn away from love. Now, the incredible splendor of nature is the visible expression of the love of creation. Creation radiates love. And when you tune in through what's called, in German, Empfinden, which is a very fine, sensitive feeling, you can start to sense the radiating love of creation. Because creation radiates love. We are very ill in our consciousness here on the earth. And we're so locked in to negative, out of control, repeating thoughts. We are numb. We can't even feel the incredible beauty of creation anymore. We are in a very bad situation. We're an insane society. We're rushing headlong to our own destruction. In the foreword of the Might of Thoughts, it says that we are consciousness. We are a society that's ill in our consciousness. And this book is designed to cure our spiritual illness. Let me again read the seventh spirit teaching prayer by Nicodemian. By means of the power of my consciousness, with my intellect and my rationality alone, I exercise the almightiness over my knowledge, the truth, my ability, my love, and truthlessness. Only my might spreads itself in me. However, no other might. Thus I am always conscious of my own thoughts and feelings, and I unfold and use my knowledge, my wisdom, and my ability. And with this I lead everything to the true love, freedom, harmony, and to the peace in me. The power of my consciousness is a distinctness to me, so I use it to my own well-being, for my own thoughts and feelings, and the psyche, as well as for my body. Did you know that good thinking leads to health? Bad thinking leads to sickness. We actually have a huge role in our own thinking. And because we struggle on the earth with our thoughts, we're very vulnerable to addictions, all kinds of addictions. We always think we can depend on something for a stimulation. People are even addicted to world domination. And there are about four groups, at least three or four groups, that are talked about in my writings that are addicted to world domination. And this is an addiction that's not so common. However, there are certain powerful groups in the world that are now attempting to bring about a world domination situation. And one of them is called the Dark Order in the Goblet of Truth. On page 69, it says, "Even the powerful ones of the economy are feeling the might and obeying the evil laws of the Dark Order, which is spreading its dangerous and fatal poison of hatred everywhere, into everything, and against everyone who does not share the same opinion as the Dark Might." Well, this Dark Order has several goals. It's trying to have mastery over the entire earth, mastery over humanity. They're focused on gaining money and power. They're spreading hatred. There is another group besides the Dark Order. There are Jewish Zionists who are trying to take control of the world. Another group, there are religious groups that are trying to take control of the world right now. One of those is the Church of Scientology, believe it or not. And Ron Hubbard was one of the groups, one of the founders of that group. So this is one addiction that's going on now, the addiction of power. And we're seeing this manifest in a very profound way. Another thing that people are addicted to, and I think everyone gets addicted in this way sometimes, and this is the addiction to your own desires. Listen to what it says here in the Goblet of Truth, page 445. It says, "This love for yourselves as people of your kind, self-love is not the same as ego love, which is a vice, a pathological craving, a self-addiction, addicted in mercilessness to its own desires, its own urges, its own drives." The Meyer information talks about a true self-love, which unfolds in the inner world of consciousness. True love is a good thing. But there is the addiction to our own desires, which manifests in many different ways. Another thing is drug addiction. And that's another kind of addiction. You see, we're instead of bearing the responsibility of our own life, we try to escape. Really, all of these addictions are escapes from our circumstances. And for some reason, the human on earth, and I admit this as well, there are times when we just would rather have a compulsive engagement in rewarding stimuli rather than deal with our own situation, with our own difficulties, with our own problems. But addiction is no escape. Addiction just makes our situation ultimately worse. Addictions, you can have addictions for food, for sex, for social interaction. Addiction to drugs, addiction to alcohol. Very, very many different kinds of addictions that we all struggle with. Part of our vulnerability to these addictions is because of unconscious thinking. And largely as a rule, most people do not think consciously. They think unconsciously. The human being is almost always the unconscious cause of the bad circumstances in his life. The unconscious mind has things that occur automatically, which are not available to our introspection. So our unconscious has the ability to actually cause bad circumstances in our life. Some of these unconscious phenomena include repressed feelings, automatic skills, subliminal perceptions, thoughts, habits, reactions, emotional reactions, which just come up automatically. Remember, these emotions can create thoughts. So your emotions flaring up can create unconscious thoughts, conscious thoughts. So our unconscious has the ability to actually affect the circumstances in our life. That's why it's so important to learn to steer your thoughts. On page 44 of the Mind of Thought system, furthermore, it is a fact that while the human being wants the good and the positive, he or she constantly prevents the achievement of the good and positive because through wrongly steered thoughts, the human being maintains wishes, hopes, and yearnings which in no way agree with what is good and positive and therefore do not harmonize with them. What is an example of yearning for something that's not good and positive? Maybe yearning for your next injection of heroin. That would be an extreme example. Maybe yearning for that fourth piece of cake is another example. It's these yearnings that we get. You have to try to get a handle on these as well. So what happens? We have a whole society that's struggling with their own thoughts. That's probably why we have, for one example, overpopulation. Because people seem to go back to the base desires continually on the earth. We're going back to our base desires, the desires for reproduction. Therefore, we have, 8 billion people? Almost 9 billion people on the earth. And that's how we get situations where we have various things that are going on in the world that are negatively affecting our environment. One of the things that we've done is not controlling how our livestock grazes, because much of the way our livestock grazes causes desertification. And this is a problem. This is the big problem that we're dealing with now. I know I've played a little bit of this clip before, so I'll advance it a little bit beyond what we've heard. And if you haven't heard any of this, you'll have to go back to some of the older shows to listen to the beginning of this clip. This is a guy named Alan Savory, and he's going to talk about desertification. So let me start this clip here. Sometimes these clips are a little slow in starting, but that's one of the big problems in the world right now, is that much of our fantastic green earth is turning into a desert. And it's a terrible set of circumstances that are happening. That and the overpopulation. And you've seen the fires. We've talked about the fires. So let me advance this and we'll listen to a little bit of this.
To create vast areas of bare ground, no matter what you do, nature covers it up so quickly. And we have environments where we have months of humidity followed by months of dryness, and that is where desertification is occurring. Fortunately, with space technology now, we can look at it from space. And when we do, you can see the proportions fairly well. Generally, what you see in green is not desertifying, and what you see in brown is. And these are by far the greatest areas of the Earth. About 2/3, I would guess, of the world is desertifying. I took this picture in the Tihama Desert while 25 millimeters, that's an inch of rain, was falling. Think of it in terms of drums of water, each containing 200 liters. Over 1,000 drums of water fell on every hectare of that land that day. The next day, the land looked like this. Where had that water gone? Some of it ran off as flooding. But most of the water that soaked into the soil simply evaporated out again, exactly as it does in your garden if you leave the soil uncovered. Now, because the fate of water and carbon are tied to soil organic matter, when we damage soils, you give off carbon. Carbon goes back to the atmosphere. Now, you are told over and over, repeatedly, that desertification is only occurring in arid and semi-arid areas of the world, and that tall grasslands like this one, in high rainfall, are of no consequence. But if you do not look at grasslands, but look down into them, you find that most of the soil in that grassland that you've just seen is bare and covered with a crust of algae, leading to increased runoff and evaporation. That is the cancer of desertification that we do not recognize till its terminal form. Now, we know that desertification is caused by livestock, mostly cattle, sheep, and goats, overgrazing the plants, okay, leaving the soil bare and giving off methane. Almost everybody knows this, from Nobel laureates to golf caddies, or was taught it, as I was. Now, the environments like you see here, dusty environments in Africa, where I grew up, and I loved wildlife, and so I grew up hating livestock because of the damage they were doing. And then my university education as an ecologist reinforced my beliefs. Well, I have news for you. We were once just as certain that the world was flat. We were wrong then, and we are wrong again. And I want to invite you now to come along on my journey of re-education and discovery. When I was a young man, a young biologist in Africa, I was involved in setting aside marvelous areas as future national parks. Now, no sooner, this was in the 1950s, and no sooner did we remove the hunting, drum-beating people to protect the animals than the land began to deteriorate, as you see in this park that we formed. Now, no livestock were involved, but suspecting that we had too many elephants now, I did the research and I proved we had too many, and I recommended that we would have to reduce their numbers and bring them down to a level that the land could sustain. Now, that was a terrible decision for me to have to make, and it was political dynamite, frankly. So our government formed a team of experts to evaluate my research. They agreed with me, and over the following years, we shot 40,000 elephants to try to stop the damage. And it got worse, not better. Loving elephants as I do, that was the saddest and greatest blunder of my life, and I will carry that to my grave. One good thing did come out of it. It made me absolutely determined to devote my life to finding solutions. When I came to the United States, I got a shock to find national parks like this one desertifying as badly as anything in Africa. And there'd been no livestock on this land for over 70 years. And I found that American scientists had no explanation for this except that it is arid and natural. So I then began looking at all the research plots I could over the whole of the Western United States where cattle had been removed to prove that it would stop desertification. But I found the opposite. As we see on this research station, where this grassland that was green in 1961, by 2002, had changed to that situation. And the authors of the position paper on climate change, from which I obtained these pictures, attribute this change to unknown processes. Clearly, we have never understood what is causing desertification, which has destroyed many civilizations and now threatens us globally. We have never understood it. take 1 square meter of soil and make it bare, like this is down here, and I promise you, you will find it much colder at dawn and much hotter at midday than that same piece of ground if it's just covered with litter, plant litter. You have changed the microclimate. Now, by the time you are doing that and increasing greatly the percentage of bare ground on more than half the world's land, you are changing macroclimate. But we have just simply not understood, why was it beginning to happen 10,000 years ago? Why has it accelerated lately? We had no understanding of that. What we had failed to understand was that these seasonal humidity environments of the world, the soil and the vegetation, developed with very large numbers of grazing animals. And that these grazing animals developed with ferocious pack hunting predators. Now, the main defense against pack hunting predators is to get into herds. And the larger the herd, the safer the individuals. Now, large herds dung and urinate all over their own food, and they have to keep moving. And it was that movement that prevented the overgrazing of plants, while the periodic trampling ensured good cover of the soil, as we see where a herd has passed. This picture is a typical seasonal grassland. It has just come through 4 months of rain, and it's now going into 8 months of dry season. And watch the change as it goes into this long dry season. Now, all of that grass you see above ground has to decay biologically before the next growing season. And if it doesn't, the grassland and the soil begin to die. Now, if it does not decay biologically, it shifts to oxidation, which is a very slow process, and this smothers and kills grasses, leading to a shift to woody vegetation and bare soil releasing carbon. To prevent that, we have traditionally used fire. But fire also leaves the soil bare, releasing carbon. And worse than that, burning 1 hectare of grassland gives off more and more damaging pollutants than 6,000 cars. And we are burning in Africa every single year more than 1 billion hectares of grasslands, and almost nobody is talking about it. We justify the burning as scientists because it does remove the dead material and it allows the plants to grow. Now, looking at this grassland of ours that has gone dry, what could we do to keep that healthy? And bear in mind, I'm talking of most of the world's land now. Okay? We cannot reduce animal numbers to rest it more without causing desertification and climate change. We cannot burn it without causing desertification and climate change. What are we going to do? There is only one option. I repeat to you, only one option left to climatologists and scientists, and that is to do the unthinkable and to use livestock, bunched and moving, as a proxy for former herds and predators and mimic nature. There is no other alternative left to mankind. So let's do that. So on this bit of grassland, we'll do it, but just in the foreground. We'll impact it very heavily with cattle to mimic nature, and we've done so, and look at that. All of that grass is now covering the soil as dung, urine, and litter or mulch, as every one of the gardeners amongst you would understand, and that soil is ready to absorb and hold the rain, to store carbon, and to break down methane. And we did that without using fire to damage the soil, and the plants are free to grow. When I first realized that we had no option as scientists but to use much vilified livestock to address climate change and desertification, okay, I was faced with a real dilemma. How were we to do it? We'd had 10,000 years of extremely knowledgeable pastoralists bunching and moving their animals, but they had created the great man-made deserts of the world. Then we'd had 100 years of modern range science, and that had accelerated desertification, as we first discovered in Africa and then confirmed in the United States, and as you see in this picture of land managed by the federal government. Clearly more was needed than bunching and moving the animals, and humans, over thousands of years, had never been able to deal with nature's complexity. But we biologists and ecologists had never tackled anything as complex as this. So rather than reinvent the wheel, I began studying other professions to see if anybody had. And I found there were planning techniques that I could take and adapt to our biological need, and from those I developed what we call holistic management and planned grazing, a planning process. And that does address all of nature's complexity and our social, environmental, economic complexity. Today, we have young women like this one teaching villagers in Africa how to put their animals together into larger herds, plan their grazing to mimic nature, and where we have them hold their animals overnight, we run them in a predator-friendly manner, because we have a lot of lions and so on, and where they do this and hold them overnight to prepare the crop fields, we're getting very great increases in crop yield as well. Let's look at some results. This is land close to land that we manage in Zimbabwe. It has just come through 4 months of very good rains it got that year, and it's going into the long dry season. But as you can see, all of that rain, almost all of it, has evaporated from the soil surface. Their river is dry despite the rain just having ended. Okay, and we have 150,000 people on almost permanent food aid. Now let's go to our land on nearby on the same day with the same rainfall and look at that. Our river is flowing and healthy and clean. It's fine. The production of grass, shrubs, trees, wildlife, everything is now more productive, and we have virtually no fear of dry years. And we did that by increasing the cattle and goats 400%, planning the grazing to mimic nature and integrate them with all the elephants, buffalo, giraffe, and other animals that we have. But before we began, our land looked like that. This site was bare and eroding for over 30 years, regardless of what rain we got. Okay, watch the marked tree and see the change as we use livestock to mimic nature. This was another site where it had been bare and eroding, and at the base of the marked small tree, we had lost over 30 centimeters of soil. Okay, and again, watch the change just using livestock to mimic nature. And there are fallen trees in that now, because these are now, the better land is now.
This is a very interesting clip on desertification, Alan Savory. So they've figured out a way to use livestock. If they keep it moving, massive quantities of livestock, if they keep it moving like the wild herds of animals, then they can take the deserts and turn them green again, which is fantastic. Anyway, you've been listening to Ohio Exopolitics. We've been talking about emotions, the psyche. We didn't really talk much about the gamut today. We've talked about desertification, the spirit form, and we talked about how to control our thoughts. Have a good day and enjoy the good weather if you got it. And we'll talk to you next time.